As you've already noted, for those of you that are here on Wednesday nights, the material that I have in your hand is material that we normally do on Wednesday night. We have on Wednesday nights been going through the whole of the Old Testament, book by book, one book an evening on Wednesday nights, discussing what the message of that book is, getting some of the details and helping understand that. And right now, we just got done a week and a half ago with the book of Job. We're Psalms and Proverbs yet, and Ecclesiastes, and I thought, you know, I'm going to cover the same material from Wednesday night. I might as well do it on Sunday morning. And this might be what you call, and I think in society now, this is called a crossover event. It's sort of like we have a television show, and you have characters that are in one show that suddenly appear in another one. Not where they're supposed to be at, but they're there, and you're like, whoa, you know, this is really unusual and strange. I don't know if I can handle this. Well, I hope you can, because what we're going to do is what we would normally do on a Wednesday night. So if you've not been here Wednesday night, this is kind of an introduction to that. Next week we'll have original material to Ecclesiastes, and as we go through the book chapter by chapter and work our way through that. But this is kind of the introductory material. What we normally are doing on Wednesday nights as we work through all the books of the Old Testament. This book of Ecclesiastes is the idea, the title of it, which is the Greek title of it, is the idea of assembling. Getting people together to hear something. And the message as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes is that you have this one. In Ecclesiastes verse 1, chapter 1 says this, the words of the preacher. Now here you got one that's coming to preach. You got an assembly of people, a gathering of people, and he's going to make things known. And as you read this, this is an individual who is the son of David and king in Jerusalem. Well, you just kind of run through that and you go, okay, for us in studying this book of Ecclesiastes, you go, well, who's the author of this book? Well, it's Solomon. Because there's only one son of David that actually became king in Jerusalem. There's grandsons and great-grandsons and the like, but there's only one like that. And you go, okay, so we're talking about Solomon. Solomon's the author of this book. He's the author of two other books in our Bible, Proverbs and Song of Solomon, or sometimes referred to as the Song of Songs. And you have these three books, and you say, well, why is it so important to hear from an individual like this? Well, because he was described as the wisest individual outside of Jesus Christ. Now, in giving him that title, that he's the wisest person outside of Jesus Christ, you also go, really? Because you look at parts of his life and you go, he was a fool. He had more than one wife. He had hundreds of wives. And you're going, only a fool would do that. And you look at him, and even in some of his life, as you find out that he loved God and he loved what else? Strange women, in the sense of women that should have been foreign to him. And he's kind of this contrast in life of, okay, he's a guy who knows everything, and yet practically sometimes he doesn't put to practice what he should know. And as you read through Ecclesiastes, you begin to realize that this is a book that is probably written by Solomon at the end of his life. And you go, what would the date be of it? It's at the end of Solomon's life before 931 BC, which is the time where Solomon died, that he wrote this. And you say, well, how do you know it? Well, he talks about all the things he did in life. All the learning that he did, all the building that he did, all of the different things he studied, all the things that he looked at. Well, early on in his reign, he wouldn't have had time to do that, but you look at the end of this and you find out he's had opportunity to acquire different things and to be able to experience different things. This is something written at the end of his life, but it's written at the end of his life not for older people, though it can be applied to older people. It's really a book for the young. Because what he's doing is saying, I've learned a lot of things, and I've done a lot of things, and here's the wisdom I'm going to give you about looking back at my life. For many of you, you go, you know, that's kind of the stage I'm in. I'm now working with grandchildren and perhaps great-grandchildren. There is a sense of wisdom for individuals who've had that kind of life experience. They can look back. Now, with many people, there's a lot of regrets and not a lot of hope. I'm talking to individuals, for the most part, as far as I know, that you're ones who know Jesus Christ as Savior, so there's a hope for you. But even with that, there are things you look back in life and you just kind of go, why did I do that? Or why did I think that was so important? Ecclesiastes kind of gives us a basis for that type of life, that you're at that stage of life. As far as your middle-aged individuals, this is a book to remind you, don't get off course here. You know, you've still got things to do before, as it talks about in Ecclesiastes 12, where they have this picture of a house and all these things that are breaking down, and it's really describing the body. You know, you still have energy, though it's less than before, and you still have opportunities to accomplish things under the sun and be able to do that. But really, this book is one that you ought to have young people read. As you get to Ecclesiastes 11 and 12, it talks about this: remember thy Creator in the days of thy youth. And what he's challenging him is to get to know God early on. Don't wait till you're older to know him. Know him when you're young. So this book is written probably at the end of Solomon's life, as we see the details that he describes there in the book of Ecclesiastes, the things that he does. If I was to give you a theme for this book, it would just seem to be this, that there's vanity or emptiness without God. If you're going to live life just for yourself, just for the moment, and God plays no role in it, it's going to be really empty. It's going to be hollow. And so what you have is a theme, and you say, why is that a theme? Because it's a word that comes up quite often, time and time again. You have it right in verse number 2 as you start off, repeated. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Okay, you get it. No, it's really, really, really empty. You know, they're repeated over and over again, all of these things that go on. And so for us, in looking at that, you begin to understand, okay, there's an emptiness. But by the time you read through Ecclesiastes, by the hints, you realize it's not that all of life is emptiness for believers and non-believers. No, it's emptiness if I live my life without relation to God. And that's what the book is really emphasizing. And so as we go through and we get next week, the handout that you will see you receive is Life with God Under the Sun. And that's how we're going to talk about it, because it's not just life under the sun, as the world would look at it, you know, these events that just go on and day in, day out, all of these things. No, that life has some meaning to it because I know God. And so we'll see that as we go through the weeks ahead. Good place for us to start is to, read through this book. So I would suggest before next week that you just kind of read through it. The wisdom of Solomon here is not like the Proverbs bite size. One verse will do you as far as a bit of wisdom. Ecclesiastes requires you to just kind of get the overall view. I mean, there's some chapters or chapters that are discussing one thought. And you ought to read through it, but as you read through it, you're going to find phrases repeated over and over again that play a role in your understanding that life without God is meaningless, useless, and empty. And you see this term, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, saith the preacher. This is just the idea of emptiness and futility. The phrase vanity of vanities is not a statement about life, but a statement of a life disconnected from God. Some have talked about this idea, and I remember discussing this at one time, and some illustrated it this way, that life is like a, and this is the time of the year to do this, perhaps you've got grandchildren, they go outside and they're blowing through this little stick and you've got all sorts of bubbles that suddenly appear like this. And they said, life is like that bubble just after it's popped. What do you have? Nothing. And that's a good way of thinking about this. If you're thinking, what is emptiness like? It's you have nothing, really, and for that. So that's one word. This phrase, under the sun, 27 times you see this as you read through it. And so you don't really find this phrase anywhere else in the Bible, but this term under the sun, and it describes life here on earth. Okay, there is not a day of life that you go through and you're not under the sun. You go, well, it's cloudy. You're still under the sun. And it's really referring to the fact of just life here on earth, day in, day out. And you go, well, what about the astronauts? Okay, they're still under the sun too. It's life lived, and it's just kind of that phrase that is used to remind you that it's just the activity here that happens day in, day out, in everybody's life. It's a regular part of life, and everybody's experiencing it, and it's under the sun. And so it's just talking about life activity underneath the sun, and it's the way that secular man views life. Person without God just kind of goes, another day, another dollar, and you get to the end of life, another day, another dollar, and you know, you finally die. And I've experienced one thing or another. And that's how they view it. And so this is not a great term, you know, under the sun. It's kind of the way that the world describes its activities. There's no real hope beyond this life. There is this third phrase, vexation of spirit. Describes one who is chasing after the wind to try and catch it. This phrase is oftentimes used with vanity. This vexation of spirit. It's sort of like a, and I don't know if you ever did it. I didn't. I always had a fly swatter in hand because I was killing bugs. But there are some who, you know, had the, you know, the butterfly net, and they're chasing after this, and they're wandering through, and it's almost impossible to catch a butterfly because there's no rhyme or reason to the pattern of their flight. And that's kind of what you're seeing with this person. They're running here and to and fro trying to catch something, and they're not quite catching it. They're close, but it seems to pass them by. And so that kind of phrase is talking about the activities, individuals that are trying to find things in this life, and yet they're so close, they think they're there, and yet it kind of goes right out of their grasp. And so you have this term used by Solomon again and again to talk about individuals who are just chasing after things that they never seem to catch up to. You also have this phrase, it's the same Hebrew phrase over and over again, but labor and travail. It focuses on the difficulty of work and accomplishing goals. You know, you're not going to accomplish anything unless there is labor, unless there's work. Even good things, and have to work for them. Nothing ever happens by, in the sense of getting things by accident. There is some toil and struggle with this. And so as you think through even getting a paycheck or getting a meal together for the family and that type of thing, there's labor and toil that's involved. As you begin to look at everything, you kind of go, there's labor and toil involved in everything. And so this phrase is used many times. But you also have this phrase, and you find it in the Proverbs sometimes, in the short one-verse Proverbs that Solomon had, but this word better. He's going to give a lot of different statements that are better. It's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Kind of going, it's better to go to a funeral than a wedding. You know, that seems not quite right to us, but as you think about it, when you sit at a funeral, what are you forced to contemplate more so than if you were at a party? Party, you can ignore the realities of life, ignore some of those things that are going on, but you go to a funeral, and reality suddenly come at you. And the Solomon says, it's better for us, that it's not bad for you to go to a feast. I mean, he's not saying go around and be unhappy all your life. But he's just saying there are times where it's better for you to do this rather than this. And you just see these kind of statements throughout as he's giving advice. This would be better than this. Not that I'm saying you don't do the other thing, but there might be for you to understand life and get a better perspective on what life is like and how you live it. There are certain things you ought to do. And so you have this idea of better throughout the passages. Now, Solomon, in his book, is extremely wise. We know with the Proverbs, as you read through them, you read a single proverb, and it's two lines usually, and they're parallel in thought. Hebrew poetry is not rhyme like what we do. We try and rhyme the last line and get them to come together. But in Hebrew poetry, it's the thoughts that either run parallel or they run exactly opposite of one another. They're a contrast. Yeah, one line says the one thing, and then the next line says something exactly opposite. Or these two things say the same thing. They're almost synonymous in what they're saying. And you have that kind of parallel structure that goes through. Ecclesiastes, you may have verses where you have that, where you have a single verse and it's got the two lines in it. But as we said, Ecclesiastes is not designed just for you to take it, you know, one single verse and another single verse. It's saying take the whole thought overall. And there is a structure to this where the writer Solomon gets you to focus in on the message he wants to by the structure. The Hebrews would have been a little bit more familiar with this because they would always be looking for this. But in the structure of the book of Ecclesiastes, you get to the point where you realize, okay, what's the central message of this book? Okay, let's just go through and visually give you what's going on here. Excuse me. Verse 1 is the title, okay? Here you got the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem, this type of thing. But then you go from chapter 1, verses 2 through 11, and you have a poem. There's a poem there. You say, how do I know it's a poem? Some of your Bibles, when they translate it, they arrange this so you know it's poetry, and sometimes you know it's just prose. It's writing a story or those type of things. But you do have in the Hebrew there, it's a poem about the brevity and insignificance of life. You have, as we'll look at next week, where it's just kind of like this. He uses the illustration of nature. The rain comes down, runs off the land, goes into the river, goes out to the sea, and then goes back up again. And you kind of go, oh, so he's kind of viewing life as just this pattern of things over and over and over again and these type of things. And so there's this poem about some of the frustrations if you're just viewing life from your perspective, not an over-the-sun perspective like what God has. So there's a poem about the brevity of life. Then you have wisdom's failure to discover life meaning. And what we mean by wisdom's failure to discover life meaning is that I'm looking at this from my human perspective, from experience and activity, where I'm trying to get answers, and Solomon goes about using his wisdom, partying, building things, acquiring things. Maybe these things will bring me satisfaction and status in life. And so there's this section that just talks about wisdom's failure to discover life and its meaning. All the activities of it. And then you have this famous poem that most people know, that there's a time and season for everything. Time to weep, time to rejoice, a time to dance, a time not to dance, time to sow and a time to rent. I mean, this poem about there's a season for everything in life. More often than not, you know, we won't experience all of these things all the time, but more than likely in life you'll experience both of them in different seasons and times. And so you have this poem about time, that life is like this, and then all of a sudden, in the middle of this, from Ecclesiastes 3:16 to Ecclesiastes 6:12, you have a series of discussions, but you get through that, and you begin to see this theme of fear God. Fear God. You know, it does have statements, and we'll talk about this at the end, eat, drink, and be merry. For today, you know, tomorrow we die, that type of idea. But in the, even the midst of that, you have this statement, you're going to stand before God. And what you find right in the middle of this is that Solomon is giving this hint, very, you know, not subtle hint, but you're seeing it time and time again, that life lived in the sense of the fear of God. And you go, what's the fear of God? The fear of God is not that I wander around hoping he's not going to strike me with lightning for doing something wrong. Though there ought to be the understanding that God sees all my actions. But what he says is this, and you have this as the emphasis, that God will judge us for our sins. But that every day that we go through life, we're doing it realizing that, A, God's given me that life and energy. He's given me the time. So how am I going to reflect that God plays a role in my life, that he's given me the life, he's given me my place in society, he's given me these opportunities? How am I going to live my life in a way that would be pleasing to God? And it's a person that fears God, lives life as if God really truly does exist and play a role in life. That's what it means to fear God. Or you find it in other passages, the fear of the Lord. And as you go through that idea is that, okay, here's a person who's living life and they're constantly relating to the fact of, okay, how do I live my day? What would God want me to do? That God actually plays a role in this, and that in my own, in the New Testament sense, that I'm communicating with him, praying without ceasing. We go, what's that? I'm talking to him all the time as I go about my life activities. That's what you're going to find as part of the core meaning. And so you kind of see this, you're building up to this fear of God. And so in the center of the book, there's this idea. And then you get further along and it goes back and you kind of have this poem about time revisited. It talks about time again. And so you have Solomon backing off this point of fearing God, and though it's still those ideas are a part of it, he's backing away from this. And then he goes back and talks about events and things that wisdom does. And even in wisdom, it fails if it's without God. Over and over and over again. And then you get to this poem about life's brevity. Once again, it's revisited, it's in a different way, but you have this poem about life just kind of going in these cycles over and over and over again. You have these statements about, you know, what life is like and, you know, teeth falling out and all of these things. You know, you're you know, strong at one time, and then the chompers, the grinders are not working very well and those type of things. And he just kind of talks about you're young. Remember the Creator in the days of the youth, because there's going to come a time where you're not going to have that strength. And then you get to the conclusion, verses 12:9-14, we'll look at this, where it just simply says this, here's the whole matter. Here's the whole duty of individuals, their responsibility. It's this, is to fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. If you didn't get what the preacher was saying to this point, at the very end, you get the conclusion. He just comes out and states it. If you missed everything I've said and you didn't catch the subtlety of it, I'm just going to now declare it to you if you haven't caught it to this point. And that's what the conclusion is doing there at the very end. So you kind of look at the structure that the Hebrews are recognized is this center portion where the emphasis is on fear God. Live life as if he really does exist. He has a part in life. He plays a role in your life. That he really is the one with whom we have to do. And so that's the arrangement of Ecclesiastes. We won't follow as, you know, close to that because there are different things we're going to talk about and discuss as we go through different subjects with Ecclesiastes as we go throughout in the weeks ahead. But that is the structure of the book for you to understand how that works out. There are a couple of key verses I just want us to look at here this morning and read through and then deal with these last paragraphs. Key verses that kind of give us the message of what we need. Ecclesiastes 1, 2 through 11. We've kind of been introduced to this starting off with the fact that there's this preacher and Vanity, vanities of all is vanity. Verse 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun ariseth, the sun goeth down, and hasteth to this place wherein he rose. The wind goeth towards the south, turneth about to the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. And you just kind of get this whole thing, and you get to verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of the things that are to come with those that shall come after. And basically what it's saying is the things that are really important to you right now, years ahead, no one's going to care because they're going to be doing their own thing. And yet future, there's going to be groups where they're going to be doing things, and there's going to be a generation that comes after them, and it's not going to really matter because they're going to be doing their own thing. And so you have this cycle where you're getting the frustration of life right off in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and there. Second passage is Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 11. And it's in this passage that just before that is a time to be born, a time to die, a time to purpose everything under heaven. But verse 11... Actually, verse 10, Solomon says, I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Then this statement about God, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. And that word world there is translated many times in other places. He has set eternity in their heart. Do you realize that in every individual there is a God-spaced space in them? That if they don't have God as a part of their life, there's this big open space. God set a place for him to be there. God's eternal. But when mankind goes, I'm going to function without him, what do they find? They find everything really frustrating. So God has set eternity in their heart. They're trying to find something, and if they don't find it in God, as it says at the end of the verse, their whole life is going to be a frustration. Because God has a place for him in every individual, for them to have him as the center of that. And so that verse there is one that is even quoted in by different individuals when it talks about the fact that even unsaved people know there's a God because they are looking for something to fill that space that God has placed there in their life to be filled by him. And they're looking for it. Ecclesiastes 11:9 through 12:1. This is a passage that I will take for teenagers and young people quite often and preach through this. It's an easy one to remember. We talk about the three R's of learning: reading, writing, and arithmetic. And you're kind of going, "Wait a second, that doesn't start with R." But okay. reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, in this passage, you have a command for young people to rejoice, to remove, and remember. Let's start on verse 9 of chapter 11. It says this, Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thine heart cheer thee in the days of thine youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart in the sight of thine eyes. And you're kind of going, whoa, 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 whoa. You tell that to a teenager, do whatever you want to do. And really what he's saying there is enjoy the energy that you have. You got time, you got energy, enjoy the time that you have. But at the end of the verse there, it says this, But know thou that for all these things, God will bring thee into judgment. So if you understand, I'm going to stand before God in judgment. Okay, verse 10. Therefore, remove sorrow from thine heart, put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. So if you're going to enjoy the energy that you have, don't do things that you're going to regret when you stand before God. Okay, it's not go out and sow your wild oats and then, you know, you'll have a pass. No, you're going to have to stand before God for everything you've done. And then verse 1 of chapter 12, and this idea, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Some of you this morning may have gotten up and just like, oh. You know, I don't know about this day, really. And there are days like that. When you're young, you know, you might not get up because you're just tired, but you're thinking, wow, there's all sorts of things to do, And then Solomon is just simply saying here, remember now thy creator now. And you've got all sorts of things that you've got in advance, that you've got planned for you and ahead of you. Put God as a part of that. When you're making plans for life, when you're looking for things that you're going to do, you're looking at your jobs and doing that type of thing of what you're going to do, or colleges, or whatever it may be, who you may end up marrying, have God as a part of that. And so remember thy creator in the days of thy youth. And so you have that as a passage. And then the last one we've already referred to is the conclusion. But verse number 13 out of this, and verse 12, or chapter 12, it says this, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. If you didn't get what I said, here it is. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Verse 14, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And so you have this that's going to go on as we go through, where you plan things in your life to do, but understand, one day, you're going to have to give account for the life that God's given you, the energy and the time that he's given you. You're going to have to give account for it. So live your life in a way that you're not, what? Ashamed when you stand before God, physically, one day. So you have these paragraphs that are here, just understand Ecclesiastes, and we'll run through this, and then we'll get to more detail next week as far as different things. But Solomon was a man who had been able to experience life to the fullest from a human perspective. He had riches and power. He used these things to build great projects, amass great collections. Sadly, he had experienced some of the sinful pleasures of this life. As we said, he's writing this at the end of his life, and so as we go through here, he's doing these things. Oh, we'll go back here for a second for those still filling in blanks. Yeah. All right. But then you have this. It says this. He addresses the perspective of the normal human being. This book was designed not just for Jews, but the whole of the world to understand. He never uses the name Lord, capital L-O-R-D in your Bible, which is Jehovah. That's the specific name that God gave for his people to call upon him, and that they had a relationship based on that name. The word that Ecclesiastes uses is that he uses the name God, which is the generic Elohim. That's just the generic name for God. And so when he's writing this book, it's not just that Solomon's going, okay, you Israelites, let's talk about things in your life. No, he's writing this almost as a tract to the whole world. Okay, understand, life is going to be futile without God. You need to find out who God is and to know him, to live life well. And so it's a tract to people. And he also uses the name for man throughout. And there's four different names in Hebrew that you can use for man. The one he chooses to use is the word Adam, which means dust, that we all have common ancestor. For individuals going, looking at this book, they're saying, oh, hey, I'm a part of that. It's not like I'm outside this experience that Solomon's having. No, we all have this experience as part of descendants of Adam. And so you have that there. Frustration comes in life to every individual. Success does not give the satisfaction expected. Failures magnify the difficulties of life. Events and affairs of life often seem unfair and twisted. He's going to talk about this. There are some occasions where you have someone who's young and healthy and they die young, and you have someone who just lives, you know, a horrible life. You know, you get these people who live to be 115 and they're like, yes, I was smoking cigars every day and I had 19 pieces of bacon for breakfast for the last 20 years. And you're going, that doesn't make any sense. How's that possible when a person who's eating nothing but vegetables and, you know, organic stuff dies at the age of 20? There's some things that are twisted in life. The accumulated effect of this causes mankind to be discouraged and hopeless with life. You know, you get to those events in life and you're just like, how did this happen? That shouldn't be the way it turned out. It sometimes does. What you finally see is this, as Solomon hints throughout the book, that life can be full, but it is connected to a reality of God. Even in the bad times. Okay, we're not talking just good times here. We're talking the bad times where there is time to rend and it's time to sorrow and it's time to mourn. It's a time of war. There can be a fullness to life if you're doing it in the reality of God. God is the one who created all the universe for mankind to richly enjoy. Understand that. There's a lot of people that sometimes from Christian perspective go, don't enjoy yourself. You know, always go around frowning. No. God gave us this world for us to be in and to enjoy and to have activity in. However, satisfaction only comes when one connects God with the activities of life. This is what fearing God means. It is to enjoy this life, but the living of this life is done with the understanding that God is the one who has given all things, and that all mankind will one day give an account to him. If you're living life like that, you'll be living a full life. And it doesn't mean you're going to have a full bank account and everything else. It just means you will live a life that is full to the glory of God. Now, one side note here, okay? This is one explanation, and I do need to throw this out here because as you read through it, they're going to say, oh, well, Ecclesiastes has horrible philosophy, okay? And it's this philosophy. There are three passages that are controversial, and you have them listed there. 2:24 to 26, 5:18 through 20, and 9:7 through 10. They've been described as Epicurean passages whose philosophy was this: eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. You had the Stoics on the other side in the Greek culture that were basically, you know, I'm going to live miserably and I'm going to last longer as a result of it. Whereas the Epicureans are like, well, you know, we're probably going to die, so we might as well enjoy ourselves. You do see statements like this. Let's just go to Ecclesiastes 5:18 and look at what exactly it says there. Solomon says this, behold that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth to him, for it is his portion, it's his inheritance. You know, eat, drink, and be merry. Enjoy everything. But you will find as you go through this that a lot of times it's not saying eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. You don't find that in Ecclesiastes, that phrase. These passages written well before this philosophy, some at least 500 to 600 years before this philosophy, are promoting the idea of enjoying things in this life. However, a close look at these verses show that they are not promoting reckless abandon like the Epicureans were. But what it's saying is this, is you need to recognize that God has a part in those activities. God plays a role in what you do and how you do those activities. And so we'll talk about it as we hit those passages, but that's one thing I just put in there as a side note. You do have individuals that go, well, you know, I don't know about the philosophy of Ecclesiastes because he just kind of says eat, drink, and be merry because we're going to die. And it's like, no. That's not what those passages say. Read the full context. And you'll begin to realize, okay, it's not saying that. It's saying enjoy life with God and be a part of that. So we will start into the chapters next week and working through this section by section. But that's just an introductory material. As you read through it this week and get ready for us going through the rest of the material in the weeks ahead, read through it. But this will give you at least a help of getting started and understanding Ecclesiastes yourself and be able to do this. Lord, we thank you for the time that we've had here. We pray that we would be individuals that would live life as if you have a part of it. We too often just go about our day and never consider you. We get to the end of the day and realize that we've just done our own thing all day without considering you. And it may have been that those things that we've done have been good and right, but we failed to, well, do it in relation to you, and that would have made the activities a little bit more full. So, Lord, help us to begin to gain this message and understand it, what Solomon's trying to get across to us, that we would live life with you under the sun, day in and day out, that you would have a part of our activities. So, Lord, as we even today are coming to a worship service here, and we praise you and have opportunity to do that. May it be that we're doing it not just because it's a habit, but because we're doing it because we know you, the one true God. And we're here to know you better, to give you the praise that you're deserving of. And so even in our activities today, may we live life as if you truly exist. Thank you for your Son, who's made a relationship with you possible, and in his name we praise you. Amen.